And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D has too many fiddly bits to leave it alone. Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 3 decades. That's a very long time. I started with first edition, and I haven't stopped yet. I've been writing for Gnome Stew for a decade now, and I run the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast.
Hi, I'm Jared, the person that's taken way too long to get something new written for Gnome Stew. Every joke I tell in this segment is about me being old and tired, but I am too old and tired to come up with a new joke this week. You can find my work on Gnome Stew as well as whatdoinojr.com, where I write opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs. After we look at the games we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about modular encounters. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
In 1986, the AD&D product called the Book of Lairs came out. This was followed up by a second volume in 1987. Now these had short, often two-page adventures that were largely about encountering a monster in its home terrain, with some additional context. One particular encounter involves 876 undead of various types in a mythical lost graveyard. Lord, that's a lot of undead. Including a gate that summons more undead, just more undead, but which some reason had an alignment of lawful good? That's very odd. This may also be the simplest puzzle in all of D&D for characters to solve, because it involves taking every single gemstone out of the gate. Remember, sometimes looting is the answer!
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, for me, the finale of the Poison Kingdom game is coming up very soon, this next weekend. I can actually say, because this episode is going to drop after we play, but that session is going to be in person. Ah, distractions! But it is also the birthday of one of our players, and it's going to be a special occasion because of his birthday. And I have made arrangements to make him, to buy a very fancy D&D Lego-themed cake. If this is awesome as I think it's going to be, because I've gone to this cake maker before, and she made my brother's birthday cake a couple of years ago, I will have pictures and I will share it in our Discord.
Nice.
We missed the last session of Poison Kingdom that we would have played because me and a couple of the other players had a weekend away for a combo baby shower gaming weekend for another friend, which, I mean, if you are an RPG gaming nerd, you should combine all life events to also revolve around gaming. So we gave her and her husband all sorts of very cute, nerdy baby stuff. And then we played games for the rest of the weekend. So lots of gaming, but no D&D. I did get to run the second session of the Old Margreave Tales of the Valiant game. In that session, they arrived in the village of Lavoka and started getting a little bit of a bigger picture of what was going on. I had the townsfolk in the middle of a funeral ceremony in the center of the village where the people who had lost someone close to them were laying like bloody handprints on a tree that had handprints from many years before. And, you know, I expected my players to kind of quietly observe and start engaging with these people. No. They started talking to the angry bull that was in a pen that was before they got to the villagers. And I actually kind of had to gently nudge them to go talk to the villagers. And that is when I discovered I have a little bit of a problem in this group. They've got no face character. Not a single one of them took persuasion as a proficient skill. Zartath, the kobold wizard, has a -1 charisma mod. Turvin, the elf druid, and Malvern, the human rogue, both have zeros. Grish, the human fighter, has a +1. Dahlia, the half-elf ranger, has a +2. And Nevren, the Sidereian warlock, has a +3. So numbers would indicate that Nevrim should step up and be the face, but his player has been playing him as a bit more cautious and standoffish and kind of more aloof and observing of things. Now, I've talked about this on Gnome Stew before, where certain players end up getting stuck playing the face of the party over and over again. Sometimes it's because they're comfortable doing it and they're good at it, but other times, it's just because no one else is comfortable enough to step up and try and play that type of character. And unfortunately, it gets a little old for those players. And in this group's case, Zartath's player is the one that usually ends up kind of stuck in the face role because, I mean, he's pretty good at playing whatever he wants to play, but he can play a face when he needs to, and he's kind of tired of it. I'm considering having a conversation with some of the other players to kind of try and offer them some suggestions on, you know, like ways they could play being a more face front character. I'm also offering the option to, like, kind of move skill stuff around so we can get at least one person with a little bit of persuasion in there. I think the only social skill that is in the whole party is Malvern the Rogue has proficiency in deception. That's only going to get you so far.
Just lie to everybody. It's fine.
Well, even then, he's only got a +2 because it's just his proficiency bonus. I'm going to basically suggest to Nevrim that he can lean into his character's natural empathy. He can still stay kind of shy and reserved, but he's a character from what the players described who would have empathy for people and not want them to suffer, so would probably be willing to step up and talk. And then there's Dahlia, who, I mean, she's not a half-elf as far as D&D rules goes, because Tales of the Valiant doesn't actually have it, but she's a noble half-elf.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what she is. So she could lean into kind of the etiquette she might have picked up from her family's court and, like, at least kind of nudge somebody towards some persuasion proficiency.
Is the warlock likely to get a familiar? Because what could be funny is if the familiar is the face for the party.
He actually already has a familiar. He has a blink dog. And actually, we've already learned that the blink dog is smarter than the fighter. I mean, Rosh is a very good boy, so he could end up being the face of the party. We'll see. Anyway, despite these hurdles, they did end up starting to talk with the villagers and learning more about what's been happening. The first kind of task they picked up was that a man asked them to track down his missing daughter and wife. And so they immediately sent off to track them, where they ended up subduing their angry pig that had kind of gone rogue and help bring the mother and daughter home. This is actually something I changed because, as written in the adventure, the little girl is supposed to be found dead. I'm sorry, I don't murder 6-year-olds in my games or even subject my players to dead children. Some of my players are parents. Their children may all be college age or older, but this is still not something you put a parent through at your table.
When I ran it, I left her alive as well because our bearfolk barbarian, the mama bear, her motivation was protecting children. And I was like, I can't throw this at her first session.
Oh, yeah. I also changed the kind of the adversary in that encounter because there is an upcoming adventure that has a similar thing in it. And I'm like, I don't want my players would make connections there. And I don't want to have to force that connection. I don't think it's necessary. So I just leaned into some other animal being upset.
Mm-hmm.
When they got back to the village, it was dusk and the disorganized villagers were getting ready to fend off another attack from a wolf pack that had attacked the previous two nights and that had killed the person whose funeral they walked in on earlier. It took a little bit to try and get the PCs to organize the villagers rather than just ignoring them and trying to take care of the whole situation themselves. The way the adventure is written, it very specifically wants the players to kind of step up and take lead of the villagers and show them how to, you know, defend their village a little bit better. Because, like, it's supposed to be like, if the players don't intervene, the villagers are all over the place. They may shoot one another accidentally. It's just chaos. Somebody's going to get hurt. And so I kind of had to be like, I kind of pointed out to Grish, the fighter, who has kind of a mercenary background. I'm like, you're looking at these guys, someone's going to get hurt and it's not going to be the wolves doing it. Grisha's player, once they kind of have that information, stepped up to be like, oh, yeah, hey, you people, you folks, get up on these roofs so the wolves can't get you. You folks with the cudgels and the pitchforks, get over here and all that. And it actually turned out to be a really good fight that put the player characters through their paces and let them actually use a bunch of their abilities that they hadn't had a chance to use before. As the one villager kind of went down, and Dahlia the ranger immediately ran over to use her talent from her background to stabilize him and all that. She's got the medic background thing. That's when they heard a blood-curdling scream come from another part of the village. And that was where they got to see the Hollow Man had come and claimed the head of one of the villagers and was walking away into the forest with it. Dun, dun, dun. There was more after that because I told them, you know, they would lose track of the Hollow Man once he was in the forest because it's kind of his nature. And they spent some time dealing with the wood wards that, actually, I have to take a moment and comment on that because the village has these wood wards, which are essentially like scarecrow things they put up around the village as part of a ritual every winter to guard against bad spirits and all that. One of my players' last names is Woodward. So we had a lot of fun. Like, I would very deliberately say Woodward instead of Woodward, because it's just,
that's great.
You know, got a little bit too much, but they have a little bit more of an idea of what's going on, what they're up against. There were clues about which victims the Hollow Man might come for next, some ideas of what they can do to stop it, and some ideas on what the kind of driving force behind all of this is. And one of the players, the rogue, of course, snuck into the priest's house and looked for tomes or stuff that might have information in it. And of course, I let him find a book, and now I need to figure out what the book says. So I got to figure that out before the next session.
I really like the vibe of that adventure because it is very much a horror movie vibe where mm-hmm. this thing comes every night until you manage to track it down. The only thing is, in D&D, once you have a party of four or five people surround a killer,
yeah,
the killer doesn't look like a horror movie thing anymore.
Yeah, and it's I don't want to say too much because this episode, one of my players may actually listen to this before the next time we play. So I don't want to say too much. So Nevrim's player, if you're listening to this, close your ears for a couple minutes. It's very much set up that the players, like the characters, are supposed to be too low level to actually take out the Hollow Man in traditional combat.
Right.
He's something like CR5, CR6, something like that, which is way beyond first level characters. But I have competent tactical players. As it was, they got a couple of good shots on him as he walked out of town. He might take one or two of them out in a straight fight, but that's not the goal this adventure is going for.
Mm-hmm.
This adventure is trying to get them to think outside the box on how to destroy this incredibly powerful supernatural creature. And they have those tools in front of them. They even kind of have a tentative plan about using the charcoal pit in town to kind of set it on fire and mm-hmm. guide the Hollow Man into that and all of that. So they just need to convince one of the future victims to play bait. And we'll see how that goes.
I was going to say, if I ran that one again, I think I might just make the Hollow Man immune to anything until you do a certain thing. Like, you know, if you get him down to bloodied, he doesn't take any more damage, but he'll leave. You know, that sort of thing.
This is a slight tangent, but I saw a suggestion recently in another RPG community that I thought was interesting. And it's when you throw a solo big bad against your party, give it two rounds before it's bloodied. Like, if the players are actually doing good and damaging it as they go, don't let them take it out before it has a chance to do some things. And that can feel a little like cheating, But if you are a GM and you've ever tried to run a solo monster against your players, you know how hard this can be. Even when I ran the kids, they took out that dragon in a round and a half. And they totally deserved taking out the dragon in a round and a half, but that wasn't as much fun for me. So it's like, I like this idea of you give the creature like two rounds to like engage with the players and all of this. And then at the beginning of the third round, it's now bloodied and, you know, the fight can go from there as normal. Provided you're not like turning your player characters into paste.
Yeah, I think the main issue I have with that is I don't want the players doing things that don't count. Like,
right.
I've hit this thing both rounds and they don't count because it's the first two rounds. You know what I mean?
I don't want to tell my players that, but it's like, this might be something I try in the future for a, like it shouldn't be done for every single monster,
mm-hmm.
but like to give a solo monster fight a little bit more oomph, I might try it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still narrate like when your players are doing cool stuff and limiting it and all of this. I want to do some of the monsters' cool stuff too.
In my case, I actually got to run both my Midgard game and Curse of Strahd since the last time we recorded, so that was pretty great. In our Midgard game, they're at sea, and I'm very glad that I had time to introduce all of the crew members to the party, because it helped me twist a knife a lot more in this encounter when it unfolded. there was a couple where they're basically making checks to make sure they can sail properly. There is kind of a decision point where they had two different stretches of sea that looked like they might sail into the equivalent of the Feywild or the Shadowfell, and they sailed around both of those and then ended up in a massive Sahuagin ambush that I had set up for them. I think this might be rougher than either of the two that you avoided.
Think we knew, like, I didn't feel like it was a three choice system, so to speak.
No, it wasn't. This they were patrolling this coastline,
yeah,
one way or the other. That it's not like you wouldn't have run into this if you did the other two. It's just kind of funny that, you know, whew, you know, we managed to get around both of those, bam, right into this one. But I had a whole bunch of Sahuagin stat blocks, so there was a couple spellcasters, there's a few barons, which are the bigger ones. There's a leader that's a little bit bigger than the barons, and they're being led by two devil sharks, which devil sharks are these massive sharks with breath weapons that the Sahuagin sometimes worship as avatars of their gods, which is kind of nice, because I think you guys picked up on the fact that the sharks don't really care about any of those Sahuagin. These are just things that worship them that they can point at other things to soften them up.
Yep.
So we ended the night with a couple of the barons still alive on deck and the sharks not really injured at all, just kind of trying to damage the ship, but they haven't really made a push again after their initial blasting the deck with their breath weapon, which can shove somebody 20 feet, so it knocks somebody off into the water as well. There is a crew member that is dead. We'll see. It's D&D, so we'll see what that means in the long term.
Kazina has plans.
But we left that one on a bit of a cliffhanger. And then in my Curse of Strahd game, my players have convinced, sort of, they don't know one way or the other, that they've convinced Strahd that they are dead, because they convinced the werewolf that works for Strahd to go say that they died. And Rahadin, who is Strahd's seneschal, in a certain section, when they go to the Amber Temple, he can be there as an encounter going there to look for guidance. So I had him like coming up the path as they're going to the Amber Temple. They narrowly avoided getting into a fight with him by distracting the nightmare that Rahadin had borrowed from Strahd, because it didn't like Rahadin. So he had to walk the rest of the way to the Amber Temple. They're starting to feel kind of bad that they're using the Spectre to scout out so many dangerous locations so that they don't, like, open a door and have to get into a fight, because they've avoided a lot of fights using the Spectre to scout for them. I'm not really against it, but also I do get, they feel like they're missing out on the dungeon crawling stuff. Like they're getting the role playing, they're getting to fight like the big villains, but they're not getting like the room to room attrition thing because they're using their specter and they kind of want to do that. It's not even like I'm saying that, it's like they're going like, I kind of want to know what it's like just to like open a door and have something jump out at us again. There was one encounter that I thought was going to absolutely be a fight because there's an Arcanoloth that's in the temple and it's guarding the sun sword that they're after. I guess I should have known this, but the elf cleric volunteered to trade her soul to the Arcanoloth.
Oh my.
Because Arcanoloths have like this book of souls and like they can in a fight like banish you to the book, and if you don't get out in a certain number of rounds, you're trapped in there. But she was just like, no. Basically, the way they negotiated this is the Arcanoloth wants out of Ravenloft. He is going to use her soul to act as a conduit so he can possess her when they all leave, so that he leaves Ravenloft whenever they find a way out. But until then, he has her soul in the book.
Okay, then.
The other development is that since I have seen Nosferatu, I made the mistake of doing the Bill Skarsgård Count Orlok voice, and now everyone wants me to do that as Strahd's voice for the rest of the campaign. If you have not heard this, it is very deliberate and slow and like consonants that would like literally cause bludgeoning damage every time.
I need to go to YouTube and look this up because I have not seen the movie.
Yeah, I mean, you think what an Eastern European accent sounds like, it is that, except it is 10 times more than you think.
You mean to say he was chewing on the scenery a little bit?
Yes.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
Whether we are running our own homebrew campaigns or running from a published adventure, sometimes you need something a little more to throw at your players. Sometimes it's a little bit of filler to bolster the campaign. Sometimes it's a really cool idea you had for an encounter that doesn't fit in with the rest of the campaign. Sometimes you just need some extra encounters. So let's talk about modular encounters that you can put in wherever you need them. So let's define it. What is a modular encounter?
Well, for our purposes, a modular encounter is an isolated scene or a discrete location that can be added to an existing published adventure or home campaign to provide more material. These usually have a straightforward goal, but often have a little more to them than just wiping out whatever monster you run into. Often a modular encounter presents a problem that needs to be solved, even if that problem is just, how do I leave this area that I've stumbled into?
Yeah. It's not necessarily part of the main campaign. You can drop it or slot it in as you need it.
Yeah, it's something that makes sense but isn't directly tied to something. Like, for example, if I dropped a modular encounter with werewolves into my Curse of Strahd game, that would make sense even if they're not werewolves that are part of the Curse of Strahd storyline.
I mean, that's one of the ways you can get around your players constantly avoiding fights is have them ambushed by something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you could give them that combat encounter they kind of want, but can avoid because they have the tools to avoid it. What is the difference between a modular encounter and the quantum ogre? And I guess this means you need to define what the quantum ogre is, Jared.
So the quantum ogre is a thing that has been discussed in role-playing circles for a while. It's basically when there is a monster in the adventure or an NPC that you want the party to encounter. It is not in one location, it is in whatever the next location the PCs go to. There's no way they cannot run into this person. A lot of times, people don't necessarily like that idea, because it can feel like they're taking away choice, because we chose to go down this hallway because we were looking for this evidence of this, and we didn't see this, so that's why we chose this, and now you're telling us, no matter what, this would have shown up here.
It does share some similarities to a modular encounter that you can put in wherever you need, but the quantum ogre is generally the term that is applied to the GMs treating this type of concept as forcing their players to do a thing they want them to do. when used badly, it is another form of railroading.
Yeah, and it's also one of those things that monster, as opposed to a modular encounter, like we were saying, that's not necessarily tied to anything else, that monster is part of what you're planning, but you're almost planning on it too hard, so you can't let go of it.
Yeah, the general description I have heard of why quantum ogres are bad is it's the characters have two paths through the forest in front of them. They've heard rumors that there's an ogre down one of these paths. The players do the work to decide that the ogre is most likely down the north path. Secretly, behind the GM screen, the GM picks up the ogre and puts them on the south path, because now the players have to run into the ogre. I ran into this in a game. It wasn't a D&D game. It was more of a kind of World War II-ish comedy game. And the GM did this to us. He basically circumvented the work we did to waylay one of our adversaries because he couldn't figure out how to do the next parts of his stories without that adversary. Basically, some Nazi commandant, we basically ambushed him. I was playing some sort of, you know, Hollywood starlet, and we ambushed him in her dressing room, knocked him out, tied him up, and went on our way to get the secret plans we needed to get to take to the Allies. And what do you know? That commandant shows up in the next scene anyway, because the GM had no imagination on how to keep things interesting and challenging. And that was the point where we realized it literally was a railroad, because the whole concept of the game was to get on a train to take the plans out of Paris. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, literally a railroad. We have been railroaded onto the railroad. It got to the point where the GM was asking us while we were on the train, what do you do? And I'm like, I don't know. You tell us.
Now, this isn't a show about quantum ogres. However, I do think there is a fine line where sometimes something needs to show up logically one way or another.
Yeah.
For example, in my Curse of Strahd game, Strahd will show up somewhere. There's no way that they can avoid Strahd forever. And if it is narratively convenient for him to show up somewhere, he will. But then again, that's kind of reinforced by the fact that Strahd is part of Barovia.
Let's be clear. If this were a video game and you as the GM were not a human being and were instead a team of devs that had created this game that you then hand to the players and let them do what they want, if the players can avoid something in a video game, good on them.
Mm-hmm.
Good on them. This is kind of why Larian Studios is the GOAT, because like they did so much with Baldur's Gate 3 to let people just do what they wanted. You as a human being running a game only have so much energy, time, ability to craft what you're going to put in front of your players. And if you have a really cool encounter that you decided was on this road and the players take a different road, oh, that kind of sucks. And if it was a situation of the players had no idea that that thing was down that road, there's no reason why you can't put it down this other road they're going down. So ultimately, like, you can think of modular encounters as work and effort you've put into your game that are tools on your shelf that you can pull in when you need them.
Yeah, and when you were talking about how sometimes you put a lot of work into an encounter and you don't want to feel like that work has gone for nothing, you can store that encounter as a modular encounter, and when you're in an appropriate place again, maybe a few sessions down the road, maybe in another campaign, you can pull that back out again, and it's become a modular encounter for you.
Yeah, very early on in my GMing days, I knew the players needed to travel from the city of Sharn to another location. This was an Eberron game, shockingly enough. They had options. They could take an airship or they could take the lightning rail. So I, in my due diligence as a new GM, made encounters for them if they were on the airship and encounters if they were on the lightning rail. One half of that effort was not used. I never ended up using the other one. They ended up taking the airship, so they got attacked by a rock. I don't remember what I was going to have attack the lightning rail, but the lightning rail one never got used again, but it was an idea I had set aside if I ever needed it. Why would a GM want to use modular encounters?
One of the things that I believe we've talked about is you can use these as your random encounters. And what's nice about this is if you've ever looked at an encounter chart and you see something like 3d6 goblins, sometimes you don't want to just say, okay, here's some goblins. What are you doing with them? In a modular encounter, you can do something like saying, here is a group of goblins. They have this person tied up to a stake. They are getting ready to set them on fire. In other words, you have a scene that you can drop in for that random encounter. In fact, the Sahuagin encounter that you guys ran into was one of like four basically modular encounters that I had set up to hit you guys if you, you know, if you rolled a random encounter on the way into port.
And I think that's one of the interesting things about random encounters. You know, we have these great random encounter tables. That's only part of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you could roll on that table and throw some goblin minis on the table or the VTT and go from there. But if you want to have a little bit better, you know, like more oomph to your game, do a little bit of planning. Figure out how many goblins are actually going to be a challenge for your players. Figure out what those goblins are doing. Why are they here? What are they doing? I did this in the Depths of Zendrick game where they were traveling through the jungles of Zendrick. I needed to have some random encounters because it was kind of, sort of a hex crawl. And I knew there were places they were going and things that they would do in those places, but there needed to be a chance for things to happen. And because I was running on a VTT, I wanted to have stuff set up so that I could just be like, okay, random encounter is happening, and go from there. We ended up using several of those. One of them was the Black Dragon attack at night, which was that one was hilarious because if they had just stayed quiet, it would have flown on by. But for some reason, Les decided to start yelling at everyone to wake them up, which drew the dragon's attention. And you ended up with a dragon fight in the middle of the night. Another interesting one was the Treant. The encounter I kind of set up was a Treant wandering through their camp. And I kind of expected it to be a fight. But immediately my players were like, oh, what's he doing here? We need to talk to him. My players were not murder hobos, which mm-hmm. I appreciated. And I very quickly had to be like, oh, I need to think a little more about this. And so, no, the Treant had been pushed out of his swamp and he was very sad because he had had to leave all his friends behind. And the players are like, oh, no, we're going to help you go get your home back, where they went and fought some demons and got the Treant his home back. And that was so much more fun than just Treant. Here, I'm a bag of hit points. Hit me.
Definitely. And I think the thing that I have heard before with random encounters is random encounters are often nouns. And what you need is like the noun and the verb.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know what the thing is doing too, because just saying a thing is there isn't very exciting, and it tends to make those things look very two-dimensional.
Yep. Another reason you might want modular encounters is when your players start going in a direction you didn't expect. You know, it's obviously in your campaign, but you didn't expect them to want to explore that building. So now you gotta figure out what to put there, and you can basically pull some stuff that you may have stashed off to the side, so to speak.
And not to be, you know, me from 5 years ago thinking I'm very weird when I say this, but not to be too much of a VTT evangelist, but VTTs are great for setting up modular encounters because you can just have a map set up with the, you know, with the images,
mm-hmm.
with the things you need on the map, and just have it in a folder and drop the PCs onto that map whenever you're going to use that modular encounter.
Like I said, if it's the type of game where they're traveling, or it's a city, or it's someplace where there are a lot of places the players can go and you can't specifically know for sure exactly what they're going to engage with, put together some encounters that you can throw in them when you need it. Because
mm-hmm.
you as a GM should be able to kind of figure out the pacing and the ebb and flow of your game and when an encounter would be a welcome diversion from staring at each other across the monitor or across the table because you've just been talking for a couple of hours. Which, there's nothing wrong with talking for a couple of hours. But sometimes you just want to punch a monster in the face.
Yes.
Is there a difference between a modular encounter and a side quest?
There is a fine line between those. A side quest can be something that ties into something you already assumed was going to be happening in the campaign. Like, for example, if you have a sword that is especially good at killing a certain type of monster, the PCs don't need it, but if they go and do this extra thing, they get it and think their life is a little bit easier. That's the kind of thing that's a side quest, and it does kind of tie into what you already have planned. Whereas, like we said, the modular encounter doesn't necessarily have to be directly related to what you're doing. But side quests are also things that feel like they are a multi-step thing to the side of the main plot.
Yeah, I tend to picture modular encounters as a little disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
You can tie them into things, but they're a thing outside of your campaign that you can pull in when you need, whereas side quests are generally going to be attached to something already in the game. Like, I find side quests are best when they're related to a particular PC,
mm-hmm.
because it helps build that PC's connections to the game world and to the rest of the players and to their own evolving story.
I am not going to say that these are the best integrated things, but one of the things I thought of as an example of a modular encounter is when you do like the Riddler challenges in the Arkham games for Batman. It's not the main plot of the story. Riddler has almost nothing to do with the main plot, but just you stumble across this thing and Riddler's like, I bet you can't do this thing. And you do that thing. And then you go back to trying to engage with the main plot again.
So what are some things we should keep in mind when making modular encounters?
We kind of touched on it before. A modular encounter shouldn't just be a number of monsters that shows up. It should be a situation, at the very least. It could be a multi-step situation, but it should at least be something that you are resolving. It, you know, it might be a thing where you have a wounded animal that another animal is tracking and you have to decide whether or not you're going to protect that animal or not. Or whether you're going to heal it, or something of that nature. It's a situation. It is not just one thing.
I would say that it can be just a bunch of monsters, especially if you really just need to give your players a fight.
Mm-hmm.
But you should have more of a reason for those creatures to be there than just, you know, like, poof, here's some goblins.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what are the goblins doing there? What are the goblins' purpose? Where are they going? What else is happening there? Why are the players going to care about this? Why is it going to become a now problem for the players?
Is it a bunch of random goblins, or is it maybe a group of hobgoblin mercenaries hired by the person that you're already striving against that has sent these things to block your path?
Right, exactly.
I think part of what you need for a modular encounter is to know how you get into the encounter and how you leave the encounter. And I do think the least interesting way to leave an encounter is over the dead bodies of a bunch of things. But that is not an invalid way to leave a modular encounter. I do like the idea of having like a challenge in there, though.
Mm-hmm. Are there ways you can take a modular encounter and make it actually fit your campaign so it doesn't feel like an add-on?
So when I mentioned that before about if I had a werewolf encounter and I drop it into Curse of Strahd, if I have those werewolves react to my PCs name-dropping that pack leader that they've run into before, that starts to tie that in. They're not just random werewolves. These are werewolves that understand the werewolf politics of Barovia. On top of that, if I decide I still want them to fight the PCs, I can use that modular encounter to introduce the fact that there was another pack leader and not all of the werewolves are happy that this person took over the pack. And all of a sudden, now you have story elements when what I originally had was a map with PCs going between these two outcroppings and werewolves jumping out at them.
I think it depends on what type of campaign you're running. If you are running something that is more exploratory, like my Zendrick game was, you're putting in these modular encounters to flesh out the world and make it feel more lived in. Whereas my Veterans of the Gauntlet game, where they had a very specific mission that they were on to go from one place to another to find these artifacts and stuff, when I threw modular type encounters at them, I would try and tie them to things they had either already experienced or were related to their character backgrounds. One of the kind of modular encounters I threw at them was one they talked about so much because I basically had them attacked by cultists. Mm-hmm. They had went to bed for the night at Redley's Tavern, and a bunch of cultists basically snuck in to the inn and were going to try and assassinate them. And they basically had this fight in the middle of the sleeping level of the tavern, where middle of the night, they're half in pajamas, half in armor, fighting stuff, summoning a goddamn bull that ran out the side of the building. And then we had this long debate about would it actually survive to hit the bottom of Sharn? And if it did, would that mean there would be meat for the people down there, or would it disappear before it hit the bottom? Would it die before it was just like my players still talk about this one, you know, and then it was tied into the fact that they put a hole in the wall of Redley's Tavern, which his wife, Mabel, was not happy with, you know, and they're like, OK, I would rather face more cultists than an angry Mabel. OK, so it's like you take these encounters and you just tie them a little bit into their backgrounds or the world itself, and that can, like, they don't feel like they're as random anymore.
It kind of ties into something that we're going to talk about here pretty soon, and that is there is a type of modular encounter which are usually referred to as lairs, which are kind of like five-room dungeons. They're not, like, quick modular encounters, but they also aren't, like, an extended adventure.
Mm-hmm.
If you have players, like what you were saying, where they want to do a specific thing, they want to fight cultists, and you have a lair that is just like this monster or this type of NPC they want to fight, you know, that five-room dungeon may be a thing that would be a fun thing to divert into because they're just itching for that kind of fight.
I did a couple of modular adventures, so to speak, when I ran the Dragon Heist game, because there were some aspects of the Dragon Heist adventure that my players really had no interest in engaging with, and I needed to come up with filler to account for them getting from level 2 to level 3 without having to force them into doing stuff that was in the book that they had no desire to do. Like, they had no desire to do any of the faction stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I came up with a side quest, a modular encounter that was basically, instead of them having to do something in the city, they had to go out into the woods and get a thing and get nature all over themselves. These were city folk. This was not their choice.
All natured up.
Yeah, it was hilarious. Speaking of lairs, what are some good resources that people can look to make these types of encounters?
Okay, so if you don't want to build all of these yourself, but you want something to choose from, Kobold Press has lots of lairs out. Like, for every one of the Tome of Beasts and the Creature Codex, they put out a lairs book, which is just a lair with one of the monsters from that book. There's tons of those resources out there. And also, there are VTT versions of them. If you're running a VTT that's already going to have the map and the things set up exactly the way they're supposed to go. Life Flourish has fantastic lairs, which have lairs from, like, CR1 through CR20 in it. And it is, again, it's like a short, like, maybe five room dungeon that focuses on a specific creature that you are either trying to avoid or negotiate with or remove to, you know, for your own safety or for the safety of others. So that's another good resource there. Ghostfire Gaming has Lairs of Atharis, which I bring this one up because it's available on D&D Beyond, and we actually used this for a playtest that we did, you know, last December, which was 5 years ago now. But I also wanted to bring up that Kobold Press has two products called Prepared and Prepared 2. And what I like about these are not layers. These are more those situations like we were talking about. Like, these have things like, there are goblins that have overturned a wagon and turned it into a toll station in between, you know, one side of the road and the other. What are you going to do? And it has like all of these details on how these goblins have this makeshift fortress set up and whether you're going to pay them off and, you know, whether you're going to get into a fight and what kind of defenses. So Prepared and Prepared 2 are some that you may want to look at if you don't just want a lair to pop into your adventure. Also, if you have old dungeon magazines, you might have to update the stats, but they used to have these short encounters in there sometimes, and they were really nice, and I miss that. I wish we still had dungeon magazine.
Yeah, I think if you poke around out there, you can find, they'll probably be called adventures, but they're really just a short, you know, one-shot-ish type of adventure that you can slot in wherever you need it. What about building a library of encounters? We talked about setting up our VTTs with stuff we can pull on whenever we need.
This is what I was saying. If you ever feel like you put too much work into an encounter to just let it go, but you really should let it go, but don't get rid of it. Hang on to it. Figure out how, you know, if you have it tied to your current adventure, cut some of those ties so that you can just plop it into another adventure. But don't get rid of those things. If you have built an encounter, especially if it's like a multi-phase, you know, fight where you're going to have three different waves of things coming in and, you know, this event is going to happen, but it's not, you know, but the PC's figured out a way to not do it, don't get rid of it. Save stuff like that and use it later.
Ideas are never wasted.
Oh, no.
You know, you may not use the idea that you have at the moment, but it's going to basically, it'll be there when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
Or it'll give you kind of the spark for the next idea
mm-hmm.
of something to do.
And that's another thing I was going to say. If you are like me, sometimes you start having all of these ideas for something that would be a really neat encounter, but it has nothing to do with your current campaign. Or you start thinking about it and going, yeah, it'd be really awesome. And all I'd have to do is run into this thing. And you go, oh, my PCs are fifth level and that's a CR16. CR16 thing. Maybe I don't want to throw that at them.
Womp, womp, womp.
When you
don't go back to the 80s where the GM grabs the wrong module and you die on the doorstep.
Yes. But yeah, if you have that idea for interacting with a monster that you just think would be really cool, go ahead and put down some notes for it. And someday there might be something that just clicks and you can drop that into your current campaign. I actually have a ton of Google Docs that are just filled with me having ideas. Sometimes it was like stuff that we never got to in other campaigns. Sometimes it's just like, oh, this is really cool. We aren't doing it, but someday I would like to do this.
This is my shocked face, Jared.
I was going to say the whole thing with the Void Dragon was kind of an encounter that I had an idea for that just didn't fit anywhere else. And so I made it fit earlier in our campaign.
Let's sum up. What's the teal deer, the too long didn't read, too long didn't listen of teal deal that of what we've been talking about with modular adventures?
Okay, so one, I would say never throw out any encounters. Two, if you're going to make one of these from scratch, know how people get into it and how people exit it. Three, I would say, remember, you don't just want a noun, you want a verb. You know, you want whatever they're running into to be doing something, to have an objective.
I will also say it is, you know, I don't know if this is bullet point four, bullet point D, or whatever you want to call it. I think it is perfectly okay to have a rough idea of the modular encounter and adapt it as you go. Like I did with the Treant.
Mm-hmm.
When you're expecting it to be one thing and the players start engaging with it another way, change gears, you know, go with what the players are engaging with. Just because you thought it was going to be a fight doesn't mean it has to be a fight. And I definitely think the know how they get into it is absolutely crucial. Know how this is going to come into play with your characters. The getting out, they can figure that out once everything is over. I mean, like, you know, that to me, that one's a, that, I don't know how they're going to get out of this. I don't know how this one's going to end. Let's see what they do. But I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't necessarily want people to think there's the only one way for them to leave. What I'm thinking more about is these things that are in the encounter, what would cause them to leave if you're not just going to murder all of them?
Ah, I understand. What's going to make them run away?
Or, you know, negotiate. Or, you know, become your best friend. Who knows?
The last thing I'll say is you don't need a whole... You don't need a great deal of connective tissue to make these feel like part of your overall campaign. Just figure out those little connections here or there. Your players will build it up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you may throw a random encounter at them and they're going to believe that this is the ultimate machinations of the big bad that they're working against. And, oh, did you believe they planned this? It's your players are going to fill in a lot of the details.
Mm-hmm.
Just give it a little bit of connection and they'll be fine.
Now let's join Ange and Jared for some downtime research where they do the work so we don't have to.
So now we are going to look at our downtime research. Every episode, we are going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. But first, our Eldritch Invocation. We have a Patreon now, so if you would like to help us do this show and help us provide some additional content for you, we would love it if you decided to join. We've got our own Discord. We will be releasing supplementary material. Chris has made a bunch of campaign high-end material for our AP. You can get the AP in big chunks instead of smaller installments. And we have also made a bunch of game material that is not directly related to the campaign. So you should check out this bundle of gifts that we are willing to give you.
For me, if you happen to be within traveling distance of the greater Toronto area, specifically the kind of southwestern side of Toronto, you might want to go check out the D&D Immersive Experience in Mississauga, Ontario. It only goes through mid-March, I think, but it really looks super cool. So if you've got the ability to go, it's probably worth trying to get there. I'm looking at my calendar to see if I can make time to actually go, since I am within about an hour and a half, 2 hours from it.
Mm-hmm.
It does require crossing that border, and I don't know if they want us right now, but I'd still like to go.
Might be able to sneak across, make a stealth check. Who knows?
Don't do that. Don't do that.
We are not advocating crimes on this podcast. So I had forgotten that this was a stretch goal for the Kickstarter for this product, but the Ghostfire Gaming's Ethereal Expanse setting guide is now available on Shard, which is kind of neat. And I have not had a chance to look at it yet. The biggest thing that I want to see is that Ghostfire Gaming does this thing with Feces where it's modular. So in other words, it's saying if you bundle these five traits, that usually means that this character is a dwarf, but you can swap out this or that. So, you know, you might have a sixth trait that you swap out and it is a different thing that lets you customize what kind of dwarf, or if maybe they don't only have dwarf parents or things like that. And it's kind of a neat system. I have not played with it a lot yet, but I want to see how that works on Shard. But more than that, I really want people to buy this so Ghostfire Gaming is motivated to put other stuff on here, because I want the Grim Hollow books that they're working on from their Kickstarter to come to Shard as well, because that's what I really want to see, especially the Monster Hunter character class.
We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast like...
The Heroes of Havel's Way. The Heroes of Havel's Way is an epic fantasy story about two young heroes, Odie and Aramon. These heroes have the potential to deal with a dire threat from an ancient time that is poised to return to the world. A Titan destroyer, Valhelmoris the Mountain Strangler, stirs. The fate of the Barony of Castakin may be in their hands. We play the game to find out. We invite you to join us on our journey. And also, Monty is there. He is our raccoon that is our friend. And we couldn't leave him behind.
Nope. We have used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope you go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.